Hello and welcome to another episode of the Melbourne Athletic Development Podcast. As always, this episode of Lateral Think is brought to you with the support of Strength by Numbers. Strength by Numbers have created an integrated clinical sports and sports performance system. The AXIT system uses force platforms, dynamometry and strain gauges to objectively measure everything from isolated movements to sports performance tasks. The system has greatly enhanced our clinical practice, decision making and objectivity. We are no longer guessing. The greatest thing is its ease of use, both for practitioners and for our clients. There are no wires, no fixed setup. It's a fully integrated Bluetooth system. If this sounds like something that you would like in your practice, visit Strength by Numbers and tell them that Melbourne Athletic Development sent you. So today, we are very excited and very honoured to have coach extraordinaire Justin Rinaldi with us. Justin, for those who don't know who he is, and we might get him to explain a little bit about it, is probably considered one of the top 800 metre coaches and middle distance coaches in all of the world at the moment. He's currently coaching two guys that are running 144 at the moment and has coached another two guys that have also run 144 while he's been coaching them. I was looking at, in preparation for this, there's been six Australians that have run 144 and you've coached four of them. To say that you are our greatest ever 800 metre coach is an understatement. And I know you'll be modest and say, oh, and that's not true, but it is. And we thought it would be quite a lot of fun actually to pick your brain and get some information out of you. So I thought we'd start with the easy questions. And the easiest one I think to ask is, how do you actually get someone to run a minute 44 seconds for an 800 meters? Because you've done it with three different people and you coached another guy who'd already done it, but he did it again.
Yeah, and I think the 144 that Jeff Risley ran, it was like 9 years after his original 144.
Which is what made it more impressive.
Yeah, and I took a lot of pride from that because...
That's usually the hard part, isn't it? It's like getting an athlete who has been at a level, and that's... I think sometimes as a coach, that's more challenging because you're like, can I actually get them to do this or am I going to fuck this up?
Yeah, that's right. And I remember seeing... So Jeff came back from Achilles surgery, and I remember seeing him... I was driving past him in Elwood, and he was limping along with a cough in his hand. And I thought, Jeff is stuffed. He's never going to run fast again. And then by chance, you know, we had a phone call 6 months later and he asked if I would coach him. And I replayed that conversation to him. I said, well, I thought you were stuffed. You're never going to run again. But this is such a good challenge. And, you know, do you want to make the Olympics? He said, yep. I said, okay, let's go for it.
Yeah.
And he took a while to transition into my training. It's a lot different to what he was used to do. But I think after the domestic season, he bought into the program 100%, had a great six-week training block, went to Europe, and ran 145.3 the first race, and then another 145, and then 144, and was back on the Olympic team for his fourth Olympics. So that was pretty amazing.
All right.
But how do you make someone run 144? Yeah, I guess that was the question. I think it's actually quite simple. You look at the event, you realise you've got to go through about in 51, say, first lap, and come home in 53. So you just got to get athletes used to running 51, nice and relaxed, and then have a bit of, you know, determination in that last 200 to finish it off. I mean, it sounds that simple, but it really
it's not easy to do, but the concept is simple. And yeah, I think that that's the important part, because I think this is what differentiates, you know, one of our other questions I had for you is, you know, what's your philosophy? And I think watching, you know, I'm lucky enough to see you guys train usually only once a week, but you're pretty good for those who are interested. Fast 8 Track Club, Justin puts a fair bit of their training up online. You actually see that this concept, as you said, of getting people comfortable to run at a certain speed is actually probably very central to the way you develop training for middle distance runners in general. Can you give us a bit of an idea of where that came from?
Yeah, I think a lot of what I learned was through trial and error myself. So, you know, I ran back when it was black and white in the 90s and won a national title. But, I had dreams myself of running 144 and breaking that national record.
Yep.
Actually, my goal was always around 143, 67 for some reason. That was just the time in my head.
Why 67?
That's just what I thought I could run.
Were you born in 67?
No, I was born in 72. So, but, yeah, so, and I tried a lot of different things. I ended up coaching myself and I say to my guys, you know, I made every mistake, so you guys don't have to make any. But one thing I think I didn't really work on was just on my actual speed. I thought that speed was, you know, running 150s with jog back rest. And I know now that's not speed. And it's great. I go down Monday and I see you guys, you know, really doing speed work. We're just 800-meter runners trying to get faster. But it is central to my program. We try to do speed all year round. And we don't.
How different is that from other middle distance programs?
Yeah, I think I see it creeping into a lot of different programs now. I'm not going to say I influence that.
But do you think that's an evolution of what's happening globally, or do you think that this has gone in and out? Because I know that there's been periods in time where middle distance coaches did more speed work, and then in my mind, at least in Australia, it shifted to much longer.
Yep.
And interestingly, in my mind, like just looking at the basic history of it, and you would probably be able to educate me on this, we sucked, right? And then it came back,
yep.
Right? And I feel like, again, you're being modest, but I think you influenced this massively, because all of a sudden we had a period there where if we saw someone run 145, it was almost like an aberration. Mm. It's like, where did that come from?
Yep.
And you made, you know, particularly with Alex Rowe, you brought this kid through and you said, okay, well, we're going to run 144. And you equaled the Australian record.
Yep.
And everyone was kind of like, where did this white guy who runs a bit funny, he's got this fro, he looks weird, you know, studying medicine, come from? And it very much is based on this philosophy that you had of like, okay, we'll get him to run fast enough and we'll get him to be able to back it up and run two laps of it.
Yeah. And I always tell people, if you're sitting in a call room of a major championship, or just even a Diamond League, and you saw Alex Rowe in the call room before, you think to yourself, that's definitely one person going to beat. And then he beat you and you'd be, how the hell did that guy beat me? Rowe had enormous talent, but he also believed in, you know, the goals we had 100%. And we set a goal when he was 15, 16 to run 144 and break the Australian record. And I said it might take 10 years, but, you know, we just want to drop a second off each year. And he did it. He improved a second each year. There was one year there, I think in 2012, he was injured. He had stressy and we didn't improve. But the next year he improved and that. But, yeah, we definitely I knew that I wanted to focus on Alex's speed. I lent on Steve Hooker, who spent a lot of time with Dan Paff. And like I've never been afraid to ask people questions. And if I've got someone like Steve Hooker there.
I think that's one of the things that's very, very noticeable about you. For, you know, we're obviously picking your brain today, but one of the things that I noticed straight away talking with you was that you would ask a lot of questions.
Mm.
And I think this seems to be a central thing for good coaches, is they remain curious even as they go. Was that something that you always had, or do you think that that's something that you developed?
Yeah, I think, I always ask questions. I remember as an athlete, I was...
Were you that annoying athlete?
Yeah, I was the annoying athlete, asked you everything. I remember I met Wilson Kipketer in 1996, and he was broke the world record in 1997, and we're at the Rome Diamond League, and he was having lunch, and I sat down next to him and just tried to ask him questions about his training, and he wouldn't tell me a thing about his training, nothing. He wouldn't give it a secret away, and then I saw him the next morning, he says, going for a run, I said, can I come with you? He said, no. I said, how fast are you going to run? He wouldn't tell me. So I've been asking questions for a long time. And even as a coach, I ask questions. I see you in the athletes doing sled pulls. And I ask about what weight's on there. Mm. And I always watch things. So I think you've got to be curious. But you also got to have your central beliefs and know the direction you're heading. I've got my hands moving forward. There is a camera there. The direction you're heading. And then still listen to the things around you, because that might help in that direction you're going.
Do you think that, like, you know, you said you've got to have your central beliefs. Are most of yours from your own experiences of developing, you know, that testing your hypothesis on yourself and then, you know, then with athletes over time? Or was there more of a formal education that you went through, or was it a combination of both?
No, I think it was just through me being an athlete and just seeing stuff that other people did around the world. In the late 90s, I was based in America and trained with San Marco Track Club, and they had a great 800-meter program there. It was predominantly around African Americans who had really good natural speed. You know, they could run 46 in training without really training for it. And I tried to do that training and I didn't have that natural speed and the program didn't work for me.
Mm.
So what I realized then is that, well, there's no perfect program for someone. You've got to actually work on your strengths and your weaknesses. And I think they actually made a mistake by not working on their speed enough, because they could have run 44 for 400 and actually improved their 800s. It's hard for me to say that, because one of the guys there, Johnny Gray, ran 142.6 and was the American record holder. But I could see stuff they could improve on and be better.
Mm.
So I guess I've always asked questions, realised things that other people were doing wrong, things that I was doing wrong, and just kept on learning from that.
Mm. I put some more like, you know, specific stuff around how you sort of see, you know, your philosophy being influenced by your understanding of physiology. As I said, is there any formality to your understanding of that? Have you gathered some of that information? Because I'm always super impressed with coaches' understanding of what is going on inside their athlete's body. And they tend to develop programs that they are very much in tune with. Okay, they understand the physiology, which is, I think, very different from what we see with, say, coaches who coach field sports.
Yep.
They're much more interested in tactics. They're much more interested in maybe like technical skills. They don't really understand, or some good ones do, but a lot of them don't really understand the physiology of what's going on. Where would you say, you know, you're placed with that, and do you design stuff with that in mind?
Yeah, I heavily lean on, you know, the VIS and the Athletics Australia, the exercise physiologists they have there. Most of the time,
keep going.
Yeah, so we look long term and think, well, if we're going to go to Europe and compete in a Dime League, we have to go through in 49:50 seconds. So let's not be afraid to do that in Australia. And we typically do go to the front and push the pace. We might not be in peak shape during the Australian season, but we're still not afraid to go out there and lead from the front and not worry about getting beaten.
Where did that come from?
I just think, going back to me when I was an athlete and watching other athletes run, I think we got into the trap of wanting to win races, and typically they'll run in 147, 146s because we focus more on winning rather than chasing a long-term goal. And sometimes you have to lose to win. That sounds stupid.
Yeah.
But you have to be afraid. You have to not be afraid to fail so you learn, as long as you're learning from it. So I think the mistakes we made in the 90s was that we didn't chase those times and really, you know, dig in and have a dip. And my athletes haven't been afraid to do that. We've lost some races, but I think we've won a lot of the races in the last 10 years.
Okay.
And the ones that count, I guess.
Yeah, well, we haven't won the Olympics, so...
Well, you weren't too far off.
We weren't too far off, but... I mean, that's good because we're still learning. We still want to get there, but...
Well, I think that was the thing that was interesting with Pete. It was like he wasn't going to die wondering.
No.
You know, he set up the race, he went out, and he led it through 600. He was on target. He didn't quite get there, but he did everything. I'm sure he probably did close to everything that you'd asked him to do, yeah. And that you guys had practiced. So... two things come out of that that I think are interesting. And one is, and I'll get you to answer this in a second, is do you think that there's a bit of a psychological profile that you have to kind of identify to get those kind of athletes, or do you develop it? And the other one is, do you think that there's other events that are missing out on not using a similar kind of mentality?
Yeah.
You can answer which one you want first.
Yeah, the first one, you know, not all my athletes have got the ability to actually lead. So I've got Brad Mathis, who doesn't have the natural speed that, you know, Peter Bowl and a Joseph Deng have.
Mm.
So we can't always, you know, get him to push race. But he runs the first lap the way he needs to run it. But, yeah, I think athletes come to me and then they know that my expectation is that we're the ones that go to the front and push the pace. Mm. And if you want to be in the program, that's what you've got to buy into.
Yeah.
If you're afraid of that, then you're probably not going to work well in my program.
Have you had people come to you and they really just struggled with that concept?
Well, like, for example, Jeff Risley.
Yeah, he was more of a
sit-and-kicker. He's more of a sit-and-kicker.
Naturally, yeah.
But it's hard when you've got, you know, I've got four or five guys in each of the Grand Prix in Australia, so they all can't lead. So sometimes it's a case where, well, Jeff doesn't have to leave. He's better off sitting at the back. Hmm. With Peter and Joseph, I actually don't tell them who's going to lead, and they don't tell me who's going to lead themselves. They worked it out themselves. So it's kind of good when you watch the race because I have no idea what's going to happen that first lap because they work out who's going to lead. But they know, you know, we want to go 50.8 and one of them is going to have to do it, so we just go for it.
Is there camaraderie around that? Is there someone goes, oh, I know that maybe I'm not in the shape, or are they just super competitive and want to kill each other?
No, they're competitive. Whether they're playing the Xbox or we're going bowling or playing table tennis or anything, they're very competitive. Yeah. I think every athlete's got that competitiveness inside them.
Mm.
Even myself, I'd love to beat them at anything I can. If I could beat them in running, I'd love to do it. I'd much rather run 144 than coach a 144 runner.
That's interesting. And we'll get to that other part that I asked you before. But I always ask this of coaches because I have, you know, and I brought this up when we did a podcast with a guy named Richard Newsham West, who's actually a physio. He was a physio for New Zealand athletics team for a long time. And I said to him, and he's quite a good runner. I think, what do you run, like 62 or 63 for a half?
Yeah.
Right? And I said to him, I was like, my thought is it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you didn't quite get to the absolute top, but you need to have at least been in that environment and trained with people that have or understand what it takes to be at that level in order to be really good at either being a support member or a coach.
Yep.
And he said, oh, I disagree with that. I've seen really good clinicians that have, you know, not come from that sport. And I said, yeah, I still don't think it's the case because the nuance is so significant when it gets to that high level that you kind of need to have that.
Yep.
Where do you sit on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard, isn't it? Because there are some coaches out there who have had no involvement and have had success. But my belief is probably that you need to be around that environment and either chasing that goal or seeing other athletes or other coaches that have achieved that and learnt off them. Because it's hard. Like when you've got an athlete walking into a call room, unless you've experienced that yourself, how can you give any advice of what to think when you're going in there? Or, you know, when someone's sitting there and there's no one talking in a call room, what to do, you know, just simply if you sat there and smiled, how would that play on everyone else's mind in that room? I know you like the psychological warfare stuff, but that's little things that I like to think about. And it's not, you know, you don't have to trash talk. If you just sat there and smiled.
Yeah, it puts everyone off.
And people go, what's that guy smiling for? What does he know that I don't know?
And, well, I think that's some of the interesting things that a lot of coaches don't, a lot of them don't necessarily get into. And I think it's interesting to kind of try and develop some of those features. Like, I think one of the things that is impressive about the mental strength that your athletes have is that they know they're going out hard. Mm-hmm. It's probably going to hurt, right? And that way of running 800, I don't know, you can tell me, but is that way of running 800s typically going to hurt more than if you sit and kick?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's the biggest challenge, isn't it? When you stand there on the start line, knowing that this is going to hurt and...
And do it anyway.
And you're the sole responsibility for it. You're the one who's going to make it hurt. No one else is going to make it hurt for you.
Well, you're not going to be waiting for it. You know it's, you know when it's going to happen.
Yeah, it's like you're inflicting this pain on yourself and you've just got to say, well, I'm going to do it regardless.
Do you ever have to do any sort of psychological training around that or even just have open discussions with some of your athletes, whether it's individually or as a group, talking about that concept?
I just think that we prepare really well for those type of races. It's not, let's just do that and see what happens. We know that we're going to go in there, we can hit our splits and we're going to be fine. So even though it's going to hurt, they know that, well, we've done this not 1,000 times because that's an exaggeration, but we've done this in training and we know we're ready for it and we're prepared to do it. And, you know, the person who impresses me the most is probably Joseph Ding because he can go into a race nowhere near as fit as he should be. And he'll still commit to it. He'll still go through in 50 point and push the pace and, you know, die in the last 100. But then he gets better for the next race. And I saw that this year in Europe.
Yeah.
He ran 147, then 146 when he died in the last 100, and then next race 144.
Yeah.
But it was just all through his commitment to actually commit to that first lap.
I think, okay, this brings me to other events where I want to get your opinion because I have an opinion on this that people probably don't like. But... do you think there's other events where we're having the same issue?
Yeah, probably every event. I mean, the 1500 is really strong in Australia at the moment. The 5Ks, I mean, Stewie's strong. Well, yeah, there's a few events that we are quite strong, but the 400, the men's 400, for example, I just think, you know, that national record's, what, 1988, 44-38, whatever it is, and no one's got really near it. And why? It's not because... we're not training as well as those guys used to train.
Well, it could be drugs, but...
it could be drugs too, but I think...
it was the era.
Yeah, but I think you can run 44.3 clean. I think I've seen athletes run clean. You know, I helped a high school athlete in America who ran 45.7 this year, and he's nowhere near training that hard.
Yeah.
So if he can do that, surely someone can run 44. But I just think we're not approaching the event the right way. Is it because... and I keep on going back to speed, but are we not having the fast enough 200-metre run is actually doing the 400. You know, if you want to run 44, you probably have to go through in 20.8. So if your PB is 20.7, you're in trouble. You look at Darren Clark and that could probably run, you know, under 20.5 or whatever.
Yeah.
And the top guys can run 19 point. So I just don't think we have enough fast guys running the 400. Maybe everyone needs to step up an event, but sometimes I think that's just the easiest solution to a problem, or maybe move up an event.
Well, my mentality is as well, is there's a lot of people that actually probably do have the speed that maybe even do it, but they don't commit to this concept of going at the pace that they know is going to hurt. So, like, as an example, yeah, our most successful 400 meter runner of this past decade basically has been Stephen Solomon.
Yep.
He's not as fast as a number of the athletes that he runs against. If you actually put him in a flat 100 or a 200, he's not slow by any means, but he goes a lot closer to the limit than they do when he runs a 400. And he's developed this ability to keep running and hold his pace so that he can, you know, he's run obviously 44 a few times. And he, you know, he ran in, it caught him out probably a little bit at the Olympics, having to run a PB in the heat. But he can do it. And the way that he does it is by going, I think, pretty close to nearly his maximum for the first 300 metres.
He hasn't got a lot of wriggle room there in the first 200. And all he has to do is look at Steve Solomon after a race to know that he's actually gone as close as he can to that limit each race.
Yeah.
But I agree, yeah. I think it's really, like, I talk about splits to my guys, and we talk about hitting, you know, 24.7 for the first 200. So we talk within tenths of a second in 800.
Mm.
So there's no reason why the 400 guys shouldn't do that, and they should know what 20.8 feels. I keep on saying 20.8. I don't know why I'm saying that. That's what I feel like you need to go through to run a 40.
Yeah, well, the 20.8 is pretty close to the world record speed.
Yeah,
those guys are going. What are they? I think Johnson was around 20.9, and then he went 22. What did he go? Yeah, 22.2 or something like
that. Yeah, but imagine a guy who's run 19.3 going through in 20.9. It must feel ridiculously easy. And that's what we want in the 800, and that's what you want in 1500. You just want that – you want to have that speed reserve so you can feel easy at that pace. I know it's probably a hot topic at the moment, anaerobic speed reserve or speed reserve, but
– well, go into that. What's the hot topic about it? Like, I agree with you. I'm seeing a lot of social media people talking about this concept of speed reserve, particularly in the coaching
community. Yeah, it's something that – I know an exercise physiologist who was based in New Zealand, now he's based in Canada. He did his PhD on it, or his thesis on it. And he was doing some tests over 50 meters.
What's his name?
Gareth Stanford.
Yep.
And you can go on Twitter.
Research, yeah.
Yeah, go on Twitter because he tweets. I don't know. He spends all day tweeting. But he puts a lot of good stuff on there. And it's you can use it in lots of sports because, you know, your max 50-meter sprint you can use in soccer, you know, AFL, even basketball and track and field definitely. So, and we'd been working on speed for a number of years, and then he came and had this idea that he was testing, you know, anaerobic speed reserve. And it's sort of something that I thought, well, that's what we've been doing. And he goes, oh, can I test your athletes over 50 metres? I go, yeah, sure, we do it every Monday. Come down. So it's something that's like, that I've had kindred to it, but something that's rang true to me. And I just think a lot of athletes need to look at it. Where's the cutoff? Does it cover 800? Cover 1500? I don't think you need to be blindly quick over 50 meters for 1500 meters, but I think 800 meters is probably the sweet spot where you want to make sure you work on that year round.
Mm.
Yeah,
yeah. I think that's sort of blown up massively, and you've obviously got people like Sanford, but it's really really big, obviously, in team sport development.
Yep.
Even in places like Melbourne, you got people. Nathan Heaney, he did a lot of the work for the MAS running in hockey, and then obviously you got people like Martin Boucher, who's based in where's Martin based now?
I'm not sure. I think it's in Canada, isn't it? He's originally from France, isn't he?
Yeah.
And Peter Lawson isn't the other one.
Yeah, and they've developed so much stuff in soccer.
Yeah.
And looking at all of these different things and measuring, okay, well, how do you develop these kind of features? And interesting, like, again, you mentioned Avish. I was talking to him about some of this stuff and how he was tried to play particularly with some of you guys and some of the other distance coaches he's working with, like the distances that they're using to kind of develop, you know, even conditioning work.
Yep.
And as you mentioned before with Bandiri, like not tipping someone over, he's like, you know, maybe we do 50 meter reps or we do hundreds rather than 200s for our, you know, more like, you know, those sort of, those reps that are not fast, but they're kind of, you know, you might do, I know you do sessions like say 30 200s or something like that. And he'd rather go, oh, let's do 50 100s.
Yeah, that's right.
Whatever it is, but that's based on that individual. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about is like individualizing your philosophy to different athletes. How do you kind of go about that process?
Yeah. And that's what I think a lot of coaches and literature says, you've got to individualize your program. My belief is that I work on speed and endurance all year round. So it doesn't matter if you're an endurance athlete or you're a speed-based athlete. We're touching both ends. We're touching your strengths and your weakness year round. So why do I need to individualize the program if I'm touching on everything all year round? It sounds probably too simplistic. What I do change is the running they do in between the sessions. So someone like a Brad Mathis might run, you know, a longer run on a Sunday, and someone like Pete and Joe might not run at all on Sunday. So even though we're doing the same four sessions, so Monday, Tuesday, Thursday and Saturday each week, it's the running in between that's sort of the individualised part of the program. In terms of the pure training sessions, they're all the same regardless whether it's a Jeff Risey, Brad Mathis or a Pete and Joe.
And is that based on, for you, is that based on their natural speed? Is it based on, like, what's that based on?
I just think they complement each other because Pete and Joe can help Brad in the speed stuff. And Brad, you know, Pete and Joe are actually unique athletes because they're actually good in both.
Yeah.
You know, Pete has run 335 for 1500 very comfortably and running only 50K a week. So I say they help each other, but they do, you know, sometimes, you know, Jeff would pull Brad and Pete and Joe along, and in the quicker sessions, Pete would pull those guys along. So I talk about individualization, but the program's the same for all the athletes. It's just the little bits in between that changes. But I think the sessions that we do complement everyone.
You mentioned that you do that stuff all year round, and to me that obviously suggests that you do more of like a complex, you know, periodization or methodology.
Yep.
Where did that come from, and why did you shift to that rather than more of that sort of sequential model where it's like, okay, we're going to do a big base of this block is going to be all endurance work, or this base is going to be, and then it's going to move to, you know, slightly speed endurance, and then it's going to go to speed or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Why did you shift to that?
I think it was 1998. I remember exactly.
It was a Tuesday.
It probably was a Tuesday. But I remember I was having a conversation with someone, and they said to me, I can't wait to do a massive base and get really fit for next year. And I thought...
Why would you wait?
I said, shit, we just spent all summer trying to get as fast as possible. Now we're just going to put that aside and try to get really strong. I thought, why can't we do both? Like, why did I spend all this time trying to get fast only to get slower and then try to get fast again? It just didn't make sense to me. And literally it was 1998, it dawned on me that maybe you can do both. So, and I tried, I probably did too much. Like, I just put everything in there. So that's why I sort of now work on the speed. And when I say speed, I mean under 50 metres, not speed endurance. So the speed stuff and then the endurance stuff all year round. And then the stuff in the middle, like the lactic sessions, which is thrown at the last minute. In 98, when I was sort of coaching myself, I did everything. I was doing lactic during the winter. It was just too much. But like I said earlier, I learned...
Explain, why don't you do some of that lactic stuff in the winter?
Yeah. And I think the thing that's changing my program, I'm doing less and less sort of lactic stuff. Sometimes we'll do some hill sessions where you get a little bit lactic, but it's not, you know, not the ones where you're crawling around for half an hour after the session and feel like your life's over. Because I just feel like if you've got that basic speed, you should be able to run, the guys can run 26. Anytime I say go run 26, they can do it. We never have to worry about it. So then we get to do those lactic sessions in the summer and then in the European summer, they can pick them up straight away. So... You know, normally I see athletes who haven't done that speed stuff on the Monday. They take maybe five or six sessions to get used to the lactic stuff again. But my guys can do two of them and they're ready to go.
Mm.
We've raced in Australia before, Pete and Joe, and have done no 800-metre sessions before the season started, and they've run, you know, 145, 146. So I'm trying to see how much we can race without doing any race prep in terms of 800-metre sessions each year, because... You know, we think about the domestic season, you've got a peak here. So we do what I call a soft peak, and then you do your hard peak for the European summer.
Hmm.
And the soft peak is try win nationals without doing any 800-meter sessions. That's the goal.
I was just going to ask a question. Do you get many young athletes who don't have much training history, or they're usually pretty well developed by the time they come to you?
Yeah, so I actually don't get a lot of athletes ask me to coach them. It's kind of, I've got a small group. I can't even think of...
Do you think that's an intimidation factor?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
I was just wondering, from the complex approach to your training, does that depend on how developed certain capacities are in that individual?
Yeah, but I can tailor it because when, you know, I coached Alex Rowe from when he was 15 through, and we had the same basic foundation. We just built it up each year. So, for example, on a Saturday session, you know, my goal was to get to a 5-minute reps or a mile distance, and we started off at 2-minute reps, and then it was 2:30, and we gradually moved up there. And by the time he was 19, 20, we got to that sort of 5-minute range. And then when Joseph Deng came down in 2017, again, he started at 2-minute reps and he moved his way up. And the first time we did 5-minute reps, he couldn't even finish. We, you know, do 4 by mile, he'd get to 3 and have to pull out. So I think if I had a young athlete, I'd adjust the program accordingly. Same with Ben Derry. She can't do 5-minute reps. Her long run's 5 minutes. So we tailor things, but the program is still the same. It's just the volume that you do within that program.
Yeah. Okay. You're going to say something?
No. The other thing that I've really stood out to me is you said speed work for you is how short distance?
Under 50 metres.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, yeah, and I think when I was an athlete, I think everyone says, the funniest thing I hear when someone says, I haven't even done speed work yet, that's the end of your season.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, you're screwed.
You're screwed. Because you think you haven't done. No, but like, to me, speed work is under 50 metres. You know, anything over that, even in 60, you can probably get away with. But once you're going over 60, it's more speed endurance. You know, so I typically work between 30 and 50 metres in my reps, which I call speed work. And then we throw a little bit of speed endurance in, but it's not lactic. It's just more running at 8 meter pace and just feeling relaxed.
Do you think that's something that a lot of people underappreciate of the importance of relative speed, you know, even for an 800-meter event where I guess people always associate with doing more volume, but it's like you said, if you can't get around 400 in 50.8, you're going to really struggle on that second 400 to get a decent time.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I think when you're looking at your coaching program, you just got to look at your event and work out what the event needs and then tailor your program around that. So, like you said, 144, you have to go through in 51. If you can't run 51, then you're in trouble. Mm. But you've got to make that 51 as comfortable as possible. Mm. Doesn't mean you have to run 45, but you have to be probably running 47, I think, to make 51 feel comfortable. So within 4 seconds. So that's the way I look at any event and think, well, that's what you need. Mm. It's funny, though, because you think, look at some of the distance events, and they sometimes close faster than the 800. So sometimes a 1500 or a 5K is one with a 52 last lap.
Yeah.
And the 800 is one with a 53 last lap.
I just remember when, I think it was Mo Farah, but also I think Bekele used to do the same thing. They'd do a 10K and they'd run the last lap in 52, 53. Yeah, and you'd be thinking, like, how the fuck are they pulling that off?
I guess that's when it starts to become much more tactical from 1500 onwards.
Yeah. Oh, they're so aerobically fit. Yeah. They might be able to run close to their 400-meter max towards the end of a race. But if you're an athlete and you think, well, can I run 55? I can't run 1500s, I better move up. But don't move up because you're in trouble because they're going to close quicker than they would in a 1500. Mm-hmm. So always look at your event and then make sure you've got the tools to cope with that event because, you know, moving up's not always the answer. I know I said that before for the 200 and 400 guys, but it's not always the answer. But you've got to be mindful of what's...
Yeah, I think interestingly, like, as you know, an athlete that I coach is now with you, which I'm really excited about and hopefully it works out for both of you, but I found coaching 800s really different to coaching shorter events. So much so that I don't even know that a lot of what you do as you go up actually transfers back the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Because so much of it is very much, you're thinking very much about physiology. Whereas as you go down, it's much more thinking about things like biomechanics, technical issues.
Determinants of maximal speed, basically.
Yeah, and you're starting to look at very, very different features. And so much of it's so skill related that you're, things like volumes and trying to develop those things are not what you're trying to work on.
Yep.
Those things almost, in some ways, almost become irrelevant, which is kind of a really counterintuitive if you have done, say, for instance, formal education in sports science, whatever.
Yep.
A lot of these models are based around concepts that are taught for energy system development because that was where the science was.
Yep.
And it's really interesting. I've noticed this, and I think it's cool that you don't really subscribe to this concept of having a lot of formal education. You kind of just experimented a lot yourself, because coaches are probably around your era and older, right? Because you're close to 50. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm 50. Thanks for reminding me.
You look great, mate. Don't worry.
Thanks.
But of your era and older, particularly if they did formal education, the science at the time was so heavily entrenched in concepts around things like energy systems, because I think that's what they could measure at the time,
yep.
that they view everything through that lens. And I don't know whether have you noticed?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And so they're like, oh, well, that's tapping this system and that's doing this. And you're like, I'm not even thinking, as a sprint coach, I'm not even thinking about, but for distance, it makes sense,
yep.
right? And particularly middle distance up, it makes perfect sense because those features are probably bigger drivers of performance. When you go down, and early on when I started coaching, I'd be having conversations with people. You're trying to learn, as you said, from these people. And they're saying these things and I'm like, I just don't see how that has anything to do with them running faster.
Yeah.
And they'd be like, oh, yeah, well, they need to get fitter. And it's like, I don't think they do.
In what way? Like, can you give an example?
Well, there's a lot of programs. If you look at a perfect example is someone like if you're a 400-meter coach, but even 200-meter coach, people would know the name Clyde Hart.
Yep.
Right? And his concept of coaching 400s is to train you, I think, almost like an 800-meter runner.
Yeah, definitely.
Plus.
I mean, that program is definitely 800-meter based.
Yeah. Well, you know, they're doing mile repeats in the winter and stuff like that, almost similar to what you're doing, yeah. right? So it's similar to that 800-meter type training. And there were coaches that would use that kind of stuff here. But it's exactly like you said. He's got athletes who naturally they can run, you know, 20 flat.
Yep.
You know, he's got Michael Johnson. If he can keep him healthy and he can keep him fit, the guy can run 19s. So it's not that big of a deal when he puts that kind of work into him. We get someone who starts out and they're running 22 seconds.
Yeah,
they're not going to get faster. They're going to get slower.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's a really hard concept, I think, for people to get grasp of, because in their mind, they do have that sort of model of energy systems. And the cool thing, I don't know how much you've been following, but it sounds like based on maybe some of the discussions you had with Steve and implementing some of that stuff of Dan Pfaff, that really started to change, I think, probably from 2000s onwards, but, you know, ideas around biomechanics and sprinting really took off.
Yep.
And became so much less about that. So I just find it interesting that for you, you kind of attacked it more from almost like a needs analysis point of view, not so much from a, oh, I'm going to go learn the theoretical literature.
Yeah, that's right. No, and I don't have, I mean, I know we're going to touch on it later on, but I'm quite busy outside of coaching.
This is good. This is a good way of bringing it in because you work for ANZ, you have for a long time, you're very senior now, you manage a lot of people. What do you think the interaction is between some of those skills and your coaching? And do you think that potentially, you know, that almost needs analysis that comes basically from the corporate world is what allowed you to kind of take that step without getting too worried about, oh, I've got to go learn all this background, say, theoretical physiology and stuff?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I think there's a lot of crossover between what I do at work and what I do at coaching. You know, managing people is managing people. It doesn't matter whether they want to be an Olympic champion or have great stats in a call center. But it's just dealing with people and dealing with people's emotions. But I think a lot of the crossovers I find is just looking at data. So particularly in a bank, there's lots of data. And I like looking at data and seeing how I can use that data, whether it's to improve processes at work or improve people's performances. And the same with athletics. I love looking at data and seeing how what I can learn from that data and how I can use that data to improve my athlete's performance. So, yeah, there's a lot of crossover, but I like to have information quite quickly because, like I said, I don't have a lot of time to spend because I'm at work all day. I can't be thinking about athletics all day and then come to coaching and do that. So that's why I don't get into the science too much because there's lots of people out there that you can lean on. Like Avish, I can lean on him. If I've got a question, I ask him.
Yeah, he can go research for you.
And that's where his passion is. You know, my passion is 800 metres and coaching 800-metre athletes. And then I lean on Avish or Ned Brophy for his knowledge to help me become a better 800-metre coach. And same at work. If there's something I don't know, I just lean on someone else.
How do you reconcile that with... I think it's interesting because, as I said, you've reached the top echelon of coaching. You know, you have people making world and Olympic finals. So it doesn't get much higher than that. Obviously, medals and winning is probably the next step. But that's
definitely.
Yeah. But the hope is that that's not too far away for you. And like, how many people did you have in the last couple of years? How many people have you had in major championships from different countries? 4 or 5?
Six? Yeah, probably like that, yeah. And I've had someone on a team since Alex made his first team in 2013.
Mm.
We've had been on every Australian 800-metre team since then. So.
Yeah. So, you know, you're at that top level. I find it interesting that you've had that level of success given that you actually have committed to being a full-time, you know, high-level corporate, you know, raider.
Yeah.
How do you sort of feel that that's worked for you and why?
Yeah, I think I've been lucky that I've been at the same job or at ANZ for 23 years and, you know, I'm what I deem as someone who's very reliable. Like, I'm rarely sick. I turn up every day. So my bosses know that if I have to leave at 4:45 or 5:00 to go to coaching, that's fine because Jay will be back tomorrow and he's here every day. We can never get rid of him. He's always here. So I think I've earned that trust over the years that I can dash out at 5:00 and not have to worry about that. I'll pick things up the next day. So, yeah, I think it's just having that good – it's, again, like I said, managing people. It's about building relationships, whether that's with your boss or with your athletes. You build the relationships and then you get the trust that you have that flexibility to get around. Do I think I could be a better coach if I coach full-time? 100%. If I could –
Well, it's an interesting question for you because I've had this conversation, I don't have to think I've told people, but I'm involved in the mentoring program, yep. I said, with Athletics Australia, you know, as a mentee. And interestingly, like talking to my mentor who's kind of been through that process, we've talked about this concept a lot because he said to me, you know, how would you place yourself if you were to become a full-time coach? And I said, look, I don't actually have any interest in doing that.
Yeah.
It's just funny you say that. He goes, I never did the same. He was always working kind of semi for the AIS or... Yep. You know, with one of the institutes doing other things as well. And the idea that once you become a full-time coach, your life is defined by the results that you get with your athletes, which is a really hard concept because you have such little control at times they do. And sometimes they do fucking stupid things.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Right? So you're dealing with outcomes that you can't necessarily influence in the way that you would like to. So... How do you, in your mind, see that would play out if you did get the chance, and I'm sure it's probably even become available to or will become available to you at some stage to be a full-time coach, how do you think you'll sort of navigate that?
Yeah, I just think, so for me personally, when I think of, you know, because you got to think of that my athletes spend a lot of time in Europe, four months a year, 5 months a year, and I can't be there, so that's 4 or 5 months a year that I'm not actually watching them train. So that's why I think in my mind, if I could be there more often for them. So it's not full-time so I can be in their face 24 hours a day. It's just that so I could travel the world and be at major championships or you know, be in Europe for 3 months to watch them train. That's where I think I'd have more value. But also you've got to think about the sacrifices that you make personally outside of it. So I spend all day at work, then I go to coaching. So that means I'm sacrificing time with my family. And that would be time I'd get back if I was coaching full-time. So, you know, I could take out the 8-9 hours of work each day and have that to spend for my family. So that's why, and that makes me happy. And I think if I'm happy doing that, then I'll be a better coach because I'm not saying I'm sad and depressed. But you can always be happier. You can be happier in everything. But, if you know, I just think if I didn't have to sacrifice that family time, I think it'd just make me a better coach because I'd be, like I said, happier. But, yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because I think that a lot of coaches would like that opportunity, but I don't know that they would enjoy it, right? And I think, as I said, you're in an interesting situation. Obviously, as I said, you've got a young family and all that kind of stuff, so maybe that's different.
Yeah, it's hard. I think, but also, there's not a lot of money, let's be honest. There's not a lot of money in coaching in Australia in track and field. Maybe if you're in the AFL world, there's a lot of money coaching, but track and field in Australia, there's not a lot of money.
It's not lucrative enough for you to leave your corporate position.
No, that's right, yeah. And you have to make a massive sacrifice leaving a job to coach that. And like I said, you don't really have 100% direct impact on the athlete's performance because 99% of what the athletes do is them, not me as a coach. I'm just help guiding them in the right direction. But it's really them. But, yeah, I don't know. I'd love to coach full-time just to see what I could do because I just think if you never try it, you'll never know.
Are your athletes full-time athletes or do they have jobs?
Some of them are full-time. Like Peter is full-time, Joe's full-time. But, you know, they went a lot of time living off hardly anything. You know, I think their NAS funding, I don't know if I'm breaching anything, but it was like 13 grand a year for something like Peter Bowl. So he's living off 13 grand a year, which is not a lot of money, particularly when you have to go to Europe and still pay rent in Melbourne. He ran well at the Olympics, you know, he's got a good story behind him and made some money since then. And so he's able to be full-time and look after himself. But someone like Brad Mathis actually works at ANZ as well. He works, you know, he works 4 days a week and fits his training around there, which is okay because I work full time, so we train, you know, at 5:30. So it's not that much. You know, that's the other thing. If I was full time, would I change my training time? I don't know. Would I change it 10:30 when it's nice and sunny? But I don't know. They'd have to cross that bridge one day. But yeah.
And I know, Jack, you wanted to ask a question about, you know, the background of someone like Pete. And what influence that has?
Well, yeah, it's something that actually you've mentioned this quite a bit, John, of talking about elite athletes, particularly the ones who reach the absolute pinnacle. They often have that background of hardship. They've often come from tough backgrounds, and as opposed to people who haven't, where that seems to create certain personality attributes and drives. Is that something that you've seen in some of your best performing athletes?
Yeah, I think so. I've been lucky, and like you look at Peter and Joe, they've come from a tough background, but they've got, you know, particularly Pete's got a loving family. So it doesn't matter where you're coming from, if you've got your family behind you the whole way, it's actually what other things would you want in life than your family there? But then you look at someone like, so you compare Peter to Alex Rowe, and Alex went to a private school here in Melbourne, went to St. Kevin's, had a great education, also got a great family behind him, and I'm not going to say he was privileged, but he was more privileged than, say, what Peter is. Does that make Peter a better athlete than what Alex could have been? Because remember, like, I don't think we saw the best of Alex Rowe.
I think this is the difference, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know these people well enough so they can tell me to go fuck myself if I'm wrong. But Alex knew that whether he did well in running or he didn't, he was going to have good opportunities in life. You know, he's very intelligent. Obviously, he's a doctor now, and he was studying some of that. And I know that there was, for both of you, frustrations through that period of, he got placed out of Gippsland, and you're like, oh, fucking hell.
Yeah, that's a long way. I didn't realise how far that was until I drove it one day.
Yeah. And that was a frustration. But to him, it was like, well, I have other opportunities in my life outside of this.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes with athletes, and I'm not saying that Pete doesn't have other opportunities, but they see the blessing in the gifts that they've been given and the opportunities they've been given, and they think, okay, well, this is maybe my opportunity to raise my position for my future.
Yep.
And it's very different when you come from an environment where it's normal for you and your family members to go to university, to get good jobs, to make good money.
Yep.
That, to me, is probably the big differentiation between those two. Like, Alex left when he was probably in the prime of his career.
Oh, yeah, Alex, he didn't get to go
and study.
That's right, yeah. And it's tough, you know, because you shouldn't think about things as making money in life, but it is tough for athletes in Australia when you're making nothing and you know you've got this skill, whether it's, you know, education or being an artist, where you can make money from it to balance it out. And we talked about people coming from hardship and stuff like that. I personally believe the best athletes in the world, the ones that have no plan B. Like, yeah, they might have plan B in training and, you know.
No, I know what you mean.
But I'm all in. This is I want to be the best 800-meter runner in the world, and that's all I'm doing. They're not going, well, I might fall back and become a doctor, or, you know, I'll practice guitar, play in a band or something.
They basically give themselves no other option.
That's
really
it.
Yeah.
And they're the scary people because they've got nothing to lose. Well, they've got everything to lose, sorry. They've got everything to lose, and they'll fight, you know. And if it becomes, you know, there's a gap in a race and that person has to take that gap, they'll do it. They'll take you out. I know we talked once at training about being a killer, but I think those people who have got no plan B are the killers.
No, of course. And, like, it doesn't even matter what level you're at. I know that a mate of mine told me a story about pro running, and he said there was a guy that he was training with and he didn't realise at the time. They go to, you know, the stall gift, and the guy set himself to try and win the 70. And all weekend he's noticing this guy's eating, you know, all his mate's food, and he's like, he's sort of like, I'll let him go. He's stealing my cereal or whatever. And this guy was actually, I think, his late 20s.
Yeah.
He was studying his PhD at the time. And goes out and the guy wins a 70 and, you know, did really well. And they were like, oh, you know, fantastic, well done. And he actually said to him afterwards, why were you eating all my cereal all the time? He goes, if you want the honest truth, he's like, I have no fucking money.
Yeah.
And he's like, I needed to win that 70 metres to actually get a grand so that I can actually pay for stuff for this trip for this weekend.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to him about it, and he was sort of saying, like, it was really interesting. The whole weekend, that guy was so fucking determined. It was like no one was going to beat him. Didn't matter what happened. And I said he had no plan B. It was either that or he was in debt.
Yeah, and that's I think that's the scariest athlete, isn't it? Someone who's got no plan B and they need to win this race. I think Pete's like that. You know, Pete looks like a friendly character. He's smiling all the time. And he is a friendly person. He'll say hi. I've got some athletes who don't talk to anyone at the track. like Pete, he'll say hi to everyone.
Oh, he walks around actually saying hello. Like, he'll actually go out of his way to say hello to people that he, particularly if he knows them.
I was in Tübingen, which is a small town about 30 minutes from Stuttgart in Germany. And he's walking around the town and everyone's saying, hi, Pete. Everyone knows him. He's so friendly.
And you're like, what's going on?
Yeah. Like it is there's not many black people in the town, so it's easy to remember Pete and Joe. But he is just a friendly person. He makes friends with everyone. But doesn't mean when he's on the start line.
He's not a killer, yeah.
He's not going to kill you. Mm. So he's good because he can turn it on and off. Some athletes can't. They're just always in that mode. Mm. And I don't think that's probably healthy because it probably puts some pressure on your life.
Too much competitiveness.
Yeah, yeah.
They get competitive in stupid things. Right, yeah.
They are competitive. Like I remember playing ping pong with Pete in 2016 before the Olympics and we got too competitive. We had to ban ourselves from playing.
He's getting out of hand.
He was getting out of hand. I didn't want to injure him. But, I think you some people can learn to switch it off. But, yeah, getting back to the story about coming from a hardship, I think that does help. But I think it's innate in you. So someone like Alex Rowe had that killer instinct and believed himself and always wanted to win. But when it came push to shove between plan A and plan B, I think becoming a doctor was plan A for him.
Is that something that you work on with your athletes? Like, are you having those conversations with them over time to say, okay, well, what are your plans? Where do you want to go? Where, you know, who are you going to be as an athlete, as a person? Or is that something that you don't necessarily get into?
Yeah, I don't touch on it too much. What I've learned recently, over the last few years, is that I can't want it. So when I say want it, want the athlete's success more than them.
And yeah,
I
think that's a real dangerous area.
It is, yeah. And I do want to be the best aerobic coach in the world. And to do that, I need an athlete to either break the world record, or win Olympics, or win multiple Olympics. That'd be even better. But I can't want that more. I can't force that on an athlete. My hope is that an athlete will come along. I know, like, for example, Joe Jeng's got probably the most talent of any athlete I've had ever. But sometimes he just doesn't want it. He doesn't want to be the best in the world. He'd rather play soccer or do something else. So I don't get frustrated anymore because if he doesn't want it, I can't force him into it.
Did you used to?
Yeah, I used to get frustrated, yeah. And to be honest, deep down inside, I do get frustrated, but it doesn't consume me.
Mm. Well, no, it's interesting you say that because I've noticed that even in the conversations with you, you used to mention it and now I haven't heard you talk about it for more than 12 months.
Yeah.
Right? Which to me suggests that you've at least found different strategies for managing that kind of expectation of someone like Joe.
Yeah.
Right? Have you actually had to go seek out help with that or have you just kind of made those decisions as a mature adult to kind of
I think just as a mature adult and it probably took turning 50 to mature. But I literally remember it was like I'm good at remembering things but it was probably, you know, December last year where I just said to myself, I can't force anyone to want something. So just stop worrying about it.
Well, you mean it's funny. There's a quote that I've been looking for it actually relatively recently, but it's from 1996 or 97 from Dan Pfaff. And it's in this old article that I found from like a little Texas newspaper when he was coaching at the University of Texas. And they're asking him questions. And one of them was about, you know, Donovan was a bit of a playboy and he would do what he wanted. And sometimes he just would, you know, like the example was he was talking to him. It was after, you know, that race that they did at the Sky Dome between him
Michael
and
Johnson and Johnson, that 150, right?
And Donovan wanted to do it because it was $1 million, winner take all. But Dan was like, this is a dumb fucking idea. Like, why are we doing this?
It's a crappy track.
Right, all this kind of stuff. But he said, like, as a coach, I had to learn that you have almost no control over people, places, and things.
Yep.
And that quote has just, like, lived in my head for a really long time. And you forget it, but then you have to remind yourself, I think, often of, like, you can't control other things. The only thing you can control is yourself.
Yeah. I think as a coach, though, you can not control, but you can try to help steer.
Yeah.
I was going to say, like, how much involvement do you have in all the other elements associated with success, like apart from coaching, but things like talking about their sleep, their diet, what they're doing with their spare time, social life. Do you talk to them a lot about those elements?
Yeah, I try not to blur the lines because I think sometimes you can get too involved in that kind of stuff and then you stress about it. I'm lucky that Pete and Joe live around the corner from me, so I run into them most days. Mm. But I don't ask them what they've been doing last night, how much – because I know – if we talk about sleep, I know how much Pete and Joe sleep. Like I've travelled with them overseas. Joe falls asleep before the plane even takes off and doesn't wake up until the plane lands. It's like he's one of those annoying people that can sleep anywhere.
On that actually, that seems to be a trait of very, very – particularly talented athletes. They tend to be like cats.
Yeah, it's
amazing.
They
just sleep all the time and then they go really quick, but then they just like lie down and do nothing else.
Yeah,
is that something you've noticed as well?
100%. It's like, I don't know if an athlete comes to you and asks the coach, if the first question should be, hey, can you fall asleep in the next 20 minutes?
Yeah, you're going to be great.
Yeah.
What happened to me then? I can fall asleep pretty quickly.
Oh,
some people, like, even on the tram, I've seen Joe, we've caught the tram from Elk Park to Flinders Street, and he's asleep before the next stop on the tram. But, getting back to the thing, like, I don't really worry about too much about the sleep because I know, and Joe loves watching soccer. Like,
middle of the night. Sort
in the middle of the night. But I know he'll sleep 10 hours during the day and turn up to training at 5 o'clock.
Yeah, okay.
It's a fine line because you want to know what's going on in their life because do you need to make adjustments for their training to cope with that? Or do I just say, well, stuff you. You know this session's going to be hard. If you turn up and you're tired, that's your problem, not mine. And that's probably a bit in my mind that way because I don't change my program very often.
But so you don't make a lot of real-time changes to...
Oh, I might, like, for wind and rain and stuff like that. But if it's going to be a hard session, it's going to be a hard session. I don't change it because someone rocks up and they're a little bit tired.
Yeah.
Because it might be an Olympic final. You might feel a little bit tired. Well,
it also might help them prepare better next time. Yeah. Thinking
you make the Olympic final, you're going to be tired because you've had two races beforehand. So.
Yeah.
You're not feeling fresh.
Well, I keep having this discussion with even a few of my athletes, and it's an interesting one. It's a topical kind of area, which is like on menstruation, right? Now you've had some good female athletes, and you've got a very good female 800 meter runner at the moment. But I always say to them, you can't buy into the narrative that your cycle is having a huge influence on your performance, right? Not because it doesn't influence, it does.
Mm.
But if you buy into that, what are you going to do at the Olympic final? Go, oh, I'm in this phase of my cycle or my period just started, and like, I'm done. You know, mentally you're checking out at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really interesting concept of, as you said, turn up knowing it's going to be hard. So if you get used to that idea of it's going to be hard or I've got a tough session or a fast session or whatever, you come ready, you know that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, I agree. And I've seen athletes coaching themselves that make a mistake of, I feel tired, I'm going to make the session easier because a classic athlete I think of is Alex Carew, who was always turning up tired and he was changing his session. He'd never do the really hard sessions. Mm. And sometimes the best thing about having a coach is making you do it. Like, I feel tired, well, bad luck. You got to do it. So I think, like you said, mentally, like, it's hard, you know, and I'm learning with Ben Derry about when she's going through a cycle and about making changes. But I'm also mindful not to make too many changes because, like you said, it could be a world chance final, Olympic final.
The thing that I always speak to them about is we need to have strategies that help you manage it.
Yep.
Right? We can't eliminate it, right? And we can't pretend like it doesn't influence, but we also then can't buy into the idea that we have to change everything because of it.
Yep.
Right? So if it's about pain management, if it's about hydration, if it's about these things, I think it's really important that you have strategies, right? And are you going to feel amazing? No, but as you said, walking into the Olympic final, I'm sure Pete wasn't saying, oh, I feel, you know, as fresh as I could possibly. He's run 144 twice in the heat and in his semi. Like, he's tired.
That's right.
Right? He's probably pretty excited and there's a lot of adrenaline, so, you know, maybe he doesn't feel that. But is he actually completely optimal in the third one? Probably not.
No.
Right? So to think that you're going to be optimal at any stage as an athlete, particularly in that kind of setting, is pretty naive.
Yeah.
So to start doing it in the wrong setting is dangerous. And I got quite pissed off actually when the excuse came from Dina Asher-Smith. You know how she said, oh, we don't know enough about this. And in a setting like that, you know, she, for those who don't know, Dina Asher-Smith, after she was cramping, you know, calves at the European Championships, I think it was,
yep.
tried to blame her period and say, oh, we don't know enough about this and medicine's not doing enough to study this, which is, on the surface, not necessarily incorrect. But at the same time, you can't tell me that's the first time she's ever had period or been in the middle of her cycle during a championship. She's been to probably 20 championships by now.
That's right. She's a very experienced athlete. And it may have impacted her. We don't know. Like I said, we don't know. But you should be able to have strategies in place.
My thought was this. By then, she should have, exactly as you said, have developed a number of strategies that would have influenced it.
Yep.
So to me, it kind of came across as a bit of an excuse because she wasn't running as well as what she would have liked.
Yeah.
You know,
and this is a really hard conversation for three males to have because we've never been in that situation. Mm. But we've had athletes in other situations that are similar to that, and we need to come up with strategies to deal with that.
Well, it
whether you look at okay, the world champs, we know the date is, we know when the tournament final is, we know your cycle is similar to that. Let's plan now, 10 months before it, and if we have to do a hard session on the same day,
yeah. Well, even you might even pick out.
Yeah.
Like, all right, you find that day one's hard.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, let's pick out to do a couple of high-intensity sessions on a day one.
Yeah.
Let's do that two or three times.
And see what the impact is. Yeah.
Yeah. To me, that just says you haven't planned for it effectively.
Yeah. And you've got to plan for the uncontrollable things.
Actually, on that.
Hope for the best, plan for the worst.
Yeah.
How deep do you go on some of that stuff? Say, for instance, with the guys going into a major championship, you said you were very specific about, okay, we're going at it 24/7 or whatever it might be. Are you down to the letter with detail on stuff like that?
Yeah, I'm probably. So, again, I'm obsessed with the 800. So when the heat draws come out, I know how every athlete's going to run. The first 200, everything. So, like, I think that's one of my strengths as a coach, is I can sort of predict how the race is going to
be. Yeah, I've noticed actually that's one of the strongest things. You actually even are visually very good at predicting paces and things like that.
Yeah, like I can tell within two steps whether someone's going too fast or too slow.
Yeah.
I think it just comes from me running for a long time. I sort of had a good judgment.
Well, it's probably more, I guess it'd have to be from coaching because you wouldn't be watching yourself run.
I know, but even when I was training, when I was running,
you had really good understanding
of
your pace.
I hit splits all the time, and I typically used to set my watch, say, for example, if I was doing 26-second 200s, I'd set my watch to beep every 13 seconds and just hit the beeps. I wouldn't really worry about whether it's 26.1 or 26.7. I'd just hit the beeps. But, yeah, I am really – like the one mistake I made this year was at the World Champs. Brad Mathis is in a heat with Brandon Miller. And Brandon Miller had led every race.
He goes out hard, yeah.
He goes out hard really every race. I said to Brad, you need to hit 25.7 for the first 200. I don't care where you are. Just hit that first hitter and then we'll cover some gaps. He ran 25.7 for the first 200 and he was leading. And we never had any plan.
You hadn't had that conversation.
Well, we never had a conversation about him leading because in my mind, and that's the mistake I made, I never envisioned him running 25.7 and being in front of the race because I just thought these athletes go out harder and always like to lead. Mm-hmm. So there's no way he can be in front. Like I was talking about him not being afraid if he was 10 metres behind in the first 200, you'll close that gap up. And when it happened, I just said to myself, oh, shit, that's my fault. Because we never discussed what would happen if he led. Mm. And I just took it, he didn't make it through. And I said to him, that's my fault, don't worry. I know it's hard to say, don't worry, it's the world champs. Mm. But I take the blame for it. It was my fault because we didn't discuss it.
Yeah.
He did everything right in terms of when he got there and it was unpredicted. He did the right things. But we should have discussed it because it shouldn't have got to a situation where he was caught off like that.
I think that's one of the interesting parts about distance running, middle distance running, that's very different to maybe what I coach is athletes have time to think.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And that that actually brings in a really interesting element. Are you having conversations with them about, okay, at this point, as you said, if you're here or you're here or you're here, maybe these are some of the thoughts I want you to kind of be starting to do, or do you just practice a more rehearsed thought pattern?
Those are kind of similar to that. I was going to ask, how much autonomy do you want them to have with being able to react based on the specific circumstances?
Yeah, that's answer both your questions.
Yeah.
100%, and we practice it in training. so I think if you practice something enough, it's like tennis. You don't go out there and hope you can hit a forehand. You sit there and you practice thousands of times. So we practice in training, so when it does happen a race, Pete talks about, I think, in one of his interviews after Comm Games, you just don't think about things. You just, by the time you think, they're gone. So it's just going to happen naturally. You don't think, then act. You just act.
Mm.
and trust that you can that you, you you're making the right decision. But yeah, I do talk about making moves. You know, at Com Games, I told Pete, make a really hard move at 300. And you watch if you watch the race, you can see the Kenyan look out of the corner of his eye and actually see Pete just as he's about to make the move. So he covered that move really well. And then I knew Pete was in trouble because he had to get in front of him to win that race. And because he didn't get in front of him at that point in time, I knew we were in trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, we do wants to be autonomous. But again, we talk about we plan for a lot. Yeah. Plan for autonomy. Does that make sense?
It's probably the last question, but I've been asking this of who I consider to be sort of curious people, which yep. is I find that, you know, intelligent, curious people tend to work on lots of little problems. Sometimes they're related to their main activities, but sometimes there are others. Is there anything at the moment that you're toying with, whether it's in your mind or out loud, that is kind of interesting you? And it might be athletics related, it might be coaching related, or are you not someone who does that?
No, I am curious. I send my athletes stupid videos. I remember seeing them one of a ballet dancer and her routine to look after her feet and what she did, what was, you know, because ballet dancers, they've got horrible feet and just the routine she went to look after her feet. And I just sent her, like, this is how dedicated you have to be to take care of the little one percenters. So I'm curious about everything. And every time I watch anything, I always relate it back in my head to Adrian Meade.
Do you think that's a coaching thing? Because I'm the same. I'll be watching a movie.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, I can steal that.
I watch a movie and think, that would be an awesome trail to run on. Yeah. Well, I could use that for hills. My wife gets angry at me because we'd drive past somewhere and I'll say, hang on, stop. I just want to measure how far the oval is around because I might want to use it one day. Hmm. We'll be driving to dinner and I'll be quickly out measuring the oval because I've got the measuring wheel in my car. So, yeah, I'm curious about everything, but it all relates back to the coaching aspects of things. So... yeah, I'm probably a bit obsessed.
I know, it makes you think of John. What's that film that you love that you talk about?
I've been watching it over and over again. Is Whiplash.
Oh, yeah, that's how you told me. It's funny because I think my phone was listening to us because when I opened it up, when I went to Netflix, Whiplash popped up.
Uh-huh. It's a great movie. I think it's been pretty heavily criticised of recent just because it's so harsh in sort of how it's pushing people. But I like a lot of the ideas and I think that some of those ideas need to be explored in the sort of psychological realm more. The hard thing is these days it's almost impossible to get, you know, through ethics to do stuff that's probably a little bit controversial. So I don't know that we'll see any of that research where you're kind of throwing stuff at people to see whether they respond positively.
That's actually a good question. Do you think you need to be friends with your athletes for them to be able to perform at the highest level?
No, because I'm not saying I'm not friends with my athletes, but I've seen other coaches successfully do it. I don't feel comfortable. I feel like I need to be friends with them because I just think to me, you build trust, and you've got to enjoy the people you're with. If you don't like the person, how can I really care about their result? So to me, I think you have to be friends. Doesn't mean you have to go out drinking with them and partying with them. It just means that if you had to drive 10 hours in a car to get from Germany to Poland, for example, you'd have a good conversation. You wouldn't sit there in silence because you hate the person or got nothing to talk about. So I do think being friends with the athletes is helpful.
All right, we might leave it there. Thank you so much for your time, mate. I really appreciate it. I know you've taken time out of your Sunday.
I'm disappointed that you're not wearing black T-shirts.
Well, I'm trying to change. I'm trying to change. But I appreciate it very much. Thank you so much for joining us, Justin Rinaldi.
Thank you very much.